Chapter 12. A short while later, he was running across the plain in the direction of the ruined city. The dank air wheezed heavily in his lungs, and he frequently stumbled with the exhaustion he was still feeling. Night was beginning to fall too, and the rough ground was treacherous. The elation of his recent experience was still with him, though. The whole universe, he had seen the whole universe stretching to infinity around him. Everything. And with it had come the clear and extraordinary knowledge that he was the most important thing in it. Having a conceited ego is one thing, actually being told by a machine is another. He didn't have time to reflect on this matter. Gargravar had told him that he would have to alert his masters as to what had happened, but that he was prepared to leave a decent interval before doing so, enough time for Zaphod to make a break and find somewhere to hide. What he was going to do, he didn't know, but feeling that he was the most important person in the universe gave him the confidence to believe that something would turn up. Nothing else on this blighted planet could give him much grounds for optimism. He ran on and soon reached the outskirts of the abandoned city. He walked along cracked and gaping roads riddled with scrawny weeds, the holes filled with rotting shoes. The buildings he passed were so crumbled and decrepit, he thought it unsafe to enter any of them. Where could he hide? He hurried on. After a while, the remains of a wide sweeping road led off from the one down which he was walking, and at its end lay a vast, low building surrounded with sundry smaller ones, the whole surrounded by the remains of a perimeter barrier. The large main building still seemed reasonably solid, and Zaphod turned off to see if it might provide him with, well, with anything. He approached the building. Along one side of it, the front, it would seem, since it faced a wide, concreted apron area, were three gigantic doors, maybe 60 feet high. The far one of these was open, and towards this Zaphod ran. Inside, all was gloom, dust, and confusion. Giant cobwebs lay over everything. Part of the infrastructure of the building had collapsed, part of the rear wall had caved in, and a thick, choking dust lay inches over the floor. Through the heavy gloom, huge shapes loomed, covered with debris. The shapes were sometimes cylindrical, sometimes bulbous, sometimes like eggs, or rather cracked eggs. Most of them were split open or falling apart. Some were mere skeletons. They were all spacecraft, all derelict. Zaphod wandered in frustration amongst the hulks. There was nothing here that remotely approached the serviceable. Even the mere vibration of his footsteps caused one precarious wreck to collapse further into itself. Towards the rear of the building lay one old ship, slightly larger than the others, and buried beneath even deeper piles of dust and cobwebs. Its outline, however, seemed unbroken. Zaphod approached it with interest, and as he did so he tripped over an old feed line. He tried to toss the feed line aside, and to his surprise discovered that it was still connected to the ship. To his utter astonishment, he realized that the feed line was also humming slightly. He stared at the ship in disbelief, and then back down at the feed line in his hands. He tore off his jacket and threw it aside. Crawling along on his hands and knees, he followed the feed line to the point where it connected with the ship. The connection was sound, and the slight humming vibration was more distinct. His heart was beating fast. He wiped away some grime and laid an ear against the ship's side. He could hear only a faint, indeterminate noise. He rummaged feverishly amongst the debris lying on the floor all about him, and found a short length of tubing and a non-biodegradable plastic cup. Out of this he fashioned a crude stethoscope and placed it against the side of the ship. What he heard made his brains turn somersaults. Transstellar Cruise Lines would like to apologize to passengers for the continuing delay to this flight. We are currently awaiting the loading of our complement of small lemon-soaked paper napkins for your comfort, refreshment, and hygiene during the journey. Meanwhile, we thank you for your patience. The cabin crew will shortly be serving coffee and biscuits again. Zaphod staggered backwards, staring wildly at the ship. He walked around for a few moments in a daze. In so doing, he suddenly caught sight of a giant departure board still hanging, but by only one support, from the ceiling above him. It was covered with grime, but some of the figures were still discernible. Zaphod's eyes searched amongst the figures, then made some brief calculations. His eyes widened. 900 years,
he breathed to himself. That was how late the ship was. 2 minutes later, he was on board. As he stepped out of the airlock, the air that greeted him was cool and fresh. The air conditioning was still working. The lights were still on. He moved out of the small entrance chamber into a short, narrow corridor and stepped nervously down it. Suddenly, a door opened and a figure stepped out in front of him. "Please return to your seat, sir," said the android stewardess, and turning her back on him, she walked on down the corridor in front of him. When his heart had started beating again, he followed her. She opened the door at the end of the corridor and walked through. He followed her through the door. They were now in the passenger compartment, and Zaphod's heart stopped still again for a moment. In every seat sat a passenger, strapped into his or her seat. The passenger's hair was long and unkempt. Their fingernails were long. The men wore beards. All of them were quite clearly alive, but sleeping. Zaphod had the creeping horrors. He walked slowly down the aisle as in a dream. By the time he was halfway down the aisle, the stewardess had reached the other end. She turned and spoke. "Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen," she said sweetly. "Thank you for bearing with us during the slight delay. We will be taking off as soon as we possibly can. If you would like to wake up now, I will serve you coffee and biscuits." There was a slight hum. At that moment, all the passengers awoke. They awoke screaming and clawing at the straps and life support systems that held them tightly in their seats. They screamed and bawled and hollered till Zaphod thought his ears would shatter. They struggled and writhed as the stewardess patiently moved up the aisle, placing a small cup of coffee and a packet of biscuits in front of each one of them. Then one of them rose from his seat. He turned and looked at Zaphod. Zaphod's skin was crawling all over his body as if it was trying to get off. He turned and ran from the bedlam. He plunged through the door and back into the corridor. The man pursued him. He raced in a frenzy to the end of the corridor, through the entrance chamber and beyond. He arrived on the flight deck, slammed and bolted the door behind him. He leant back against the door, breathing hard. Within seconds, a hand started beating on the door. From somewhere on the flight deck, a metallic voice addressed him.
"Passengers are not allowed on the flight deck. Please return to your seat and wait for the ship to take off. Coffee and biscuits are being served. This is your autopilot speaking. Please return to your seat."
Zaphod said nothing. He breathed hard. Behind him, the hand continued to knock on the door.
"Please return to your seat," repeated the autopilot. "Passengers are not allowed on the flight deck."
"I'm not a passenger," panted Zaphod.
"Please return to your seat."
"I'm not a passenger," shouted Zaphod again.
"Please return to your seat."
"I'm not a... Hello, can you hear me?"
"Please return to your seat."
"You're the autopilot?" said Zaphod.
"Yes,"
said the voice from the flight console. "You're in charge of this ship?"
"Yes," said the voice again. "There has been a delay. Passengers are to be kept temporarily in suspended animation for their comfort and convenience. Coffee and biscuits are served every year, after which passengers are returned to suspended animation for their continued comfort and convenience. Departure will take place when the flight stores are complete. We apologize for the delay."
Zaphod moved away from the door, on which the pounding had now ceased. He approached the flight console. "Delay?" he cried. "Have you seen the world outside this ship? It's a wasteland, a desert. Civilization's been and gone, man. There are no lemon-soaked paper napkins on their way from anywhere."
"The statistical likelihood," continued the autopilot primly, "is that other civilizations will arise. There will one day be lemon-soaked paper napkins. Till then, there will be a short delay. Please return to your seat."
"But..." But at that moment, the door opened. Zaphod spun round to see the man who had pursued him standing there. He carried a large briefcase. He was smartly dressed, and his hair was short. He had no beard and no long fingernails. "Zaphod Beeblebrox," he said. "My name is Zani Whoop. I believe you wanted to see me." Zaphod Beeblebrox whittered. His mouth said foolish things. He dropped into a chair.
Oh, man, where did you spring from?" he said.
"I have been waiting here for you," he said in a businesslike tone. He put the briefcase down and sat in another chair. "I am glad you followed instructions," he said. "I was a bit nervous that you might have left my office by the door rather than the window. Then you would have been in trouble." Safewa shook his head at him and burbled. When you entered the door of my office, you entered my electronically synthesized universe, he explained. If you'd left by the door, you would have been back in the real one. The artificial one works from here. He patted the briefcase smugly. Zaphod glared at him with resentment and loathing. What's the difference? He muttered.
Nothing, said Zarniwoop. They are identical. Oh, except that I think the Frogstar fighters are grey in the real universe.
What's going on? Spat Zaphod.
Simple, said Zarniwoop. His self-assurance and smugness made Zaphod seethe.
Very simple, repeated Zarniwoop. I discovered the coordinates at which this man could be found, the man who rules the universe, and discovered that his world was protected by an improbability field. To protect my secret and myself, I retreated to the safety of this totally artificial universe and hid myself away in a forgotten cruise liner. I was secure. Meanwhile, you and I...
You and I? Said Zaphod angrily. You mean I knew you?
Yes, said Zarniwoop. We knew each other well.
I had no taste, said Zaphod, and resumed a sullen silence.
Meanwhile, you and I arranged that you would steal the improbability drive ship, the only one which could reach the ruler's world, and bring it to me here. This you have now done, I trust, and I congratulate you. He smiled a tight little smile, which Zaphod wanted to hit with a brick.
Oh, and in case you're wondering, added Zarniwoop, this universe was created specially for you to come to. You are therefore the most important person in this universe. You would never, he said with an even more brickable smile, have survived the total perspective vortex in the real one. Shall we go?
Where? Said Zaphod sullenly. He felt collapsed.
To your ship, the Heart of Gold. You did bring it, I trust.
No.
Where is your jacket?
Zaphod looked at him in mystification.
My jacket? I took it off. It's outside.
Good. We will go and find it. Zarniwoop stood up and gestured to Zaphod to follow him. Out in the entrance chamber again, they could hear the screams of the passengers being fed coffee and biscuits.
It has not been a pleasant experience waiting for you, said Zarniwoop.
Not pleasant for you? Bawled Zaphod. How do you think...
Zarniwoop held up a silencing finger as the hatchway swung open. A few feet away from them, they could see Zaphod's jacket lying in the debris.
Very remarkable and very powerful ship, said Zarniwoop. Watch.
As they watched, the pocket on the jacket suddenly bulged. It split. It ripped. The small metal model of the Heart of Gold that Zaphod had been bewildered to discover in his pocket was growing. It grew, it continued to grow. It reached, after 2 minutes, its full size.
At an improbability level, said Zarniwoop, of, oh, I don't know, but something very, very large.
Zaphod swayed. You mean I had it with me all the time?
Zarniwoop smiled. He lifted up his briefcase and opened it. He twisted a single switch inside it.
Goodbye, artificial universe, he said. Hello, real one.
The scene before them shimmered briefly. And reappeared exactly as before.
You see? Said Zarniwoop. Exactly the same.
You mean, repeated Zaphod tautly, that I had it with me all the time?
Oh, yes, said Zarniwoop. Of course, I mean, that was the whole point.
That's it, said Zaphod. You can count me out. From here on in, you can count me out. I've had all I want of this. You play your own games.
I'm afraid you cannot leave, said Zarniwoop. You are entwined in the improbability field. You cannot escape.
He smiled the smile that Zaphod had wanted to hit, and this time Zaphod hit it.
Chapter 13. Ford Prefect bounded up to the bridge of the Heart of Gold.
Trillian! Arthur! He shouted. It's working! The ship's reactivated!
Trillian and Arthur were asleep on the floor.
Come on, you guys. We're going. We're off, he said, kicking them awake.
Hi there, guys,
twittered the computer.
It's really great to be back with you again, I can tell you, and I just want to say that...
Shut up, said Ford. Just tell us where the hell we are.
Frogstar World B, and man, it's a dump, said Zaphod, running onto the bridge.
Hi, guys, you must be so amazingly glad to see me. You can't even find words to tell me what a cool fruit I am.
What a what? Said Arthur, blearily picking himself up from the floor and not taking any of this in.
I know how you feel, said Zaphod.
I'm so great, even I get tongue-tied talking to myself. Hey, it's good to see you, Trillian Ford, Monkey Man. Hey, computer.
Hi there, Mr. Beaverbrook, sir. It sure is a great honor to...
Shut up and get us out of here. Fast, fast, fast.
Sure thing, fella. Where do you want to go?
Anywhere. Doesn't matter, shouted Zaphod. Yes, it does, he said again. We want to go to the nearest place to eat.
Sure thing,
said the computer happily, and a massive explosion rocked the bridge. When Zaniwoop entered, a minute or so later, with a black eye, he regarded the four wisps of smoke with interest. Chapter 14. Four inert bodies sank through spinning blackness. Consciousness had died. Cold oblivion pulled the bodies down and down into the pit of unbeing. The roar of silence echoed dismally around them, and they sank at last into a dark and bitter sea of heaving red that slowly engulfed them, seemingly forever. After what seemed an eternity, the sea receded and left them lying on a cold, hard shore, the flotsam and jetsam of the stream of life, the universe, and everything. Cold spasms shook them. Lights danced sickeningly around them. The cold, hard shore tipped and spanned and then stood still. It shone darkly. It was a very highly polished, cold, hard shore. A green blur watched them disapprovingly. It coughed. Good evening, madam, gentlemen, it said. Do you have a reservation? Fort Prefect's consciousness snapped back like elastic, making his brain smart. He looked up woozily at the green blur. Reservation? He said weakly. Yes, sir, said the green blur. Do you need a reservation for the afterlife? Insofar as it is possible for a green blur to arch its eyebrows disdainfully, this is what the green blur now did. Afterlife, sir, it said. Arthur Dent was grappling with his consciousness the way one grapples with a lost bar of soap in the bath. Is this the afterlife? He stammered. Well, I assume so, said Ford Prefect, trying to work out which way was up. He tested the theory that it must lie in the opposite direction from the cold, hard shore on which he was lying, and staggered to what he hoped were his feet. I mean, he said, swaying gently, there's no way we could have survived that blast, is there? No, muttered Arthur. He had raised himself up onto his elbows, but it didn't seem to improve things. He slumped down again. No, said Trillian, standing up. No way at all. A dull, hoarse, gurgling sound came from the floor. It was Zaphod Beeblebrox attempting to speak. I certainly didn't survive, he gurgled. I was a total goner, wham bang, and that was it. Yeah, thanks to you, said Ford. We didn't stand a chance. We must have been blown to bits, arms, legs, everywhere. Yeah, said Zaphod, struggling noisily to his feet. If the lady and gentleman would care to order drinks, said the green blur, hovering impatiently beside them. Kapow! Splat! Continued Zaphod, instantaneously zonked into our component molecules. Hey, Ford, he said, identifying one of the slowly solidifying blurs around him. Did you get that thing of your whole life flashing before you? You got that too, said Ford, your whole life? Yeah, said Zaphod. At least I assume it was mine. I spent a lot of time out of my skulls, you know. He looked around him at the various shapes that were at last becoming proper shapes instead of vague and wobbling shapeless shapes. So, he said. So what? Said Ford. So here we are, said Zaphod hesitantly. Lying dead. Standing, Trillian corrected him. Standing dead, continued Zaphod, in this desolate... Restaurant, said Arthur Dent, who had got to his feet and could now, much to his surprise, see clearly. That is to say, the thing that surprised him was not that he could see, but what he could see.
Here we are, continued Zaphod doggedly, standing dead in this desolate...
5-star, said Trillian.
Restaurant, concluded Zaphod.
Odd, isn't it? Said Ford.
Yeah.
Nice chandeliers, though, said Trillian. They looked about themselves in bemusement.
Not so much an afterlife, said Arthur. More a sort of après-vie. The chandeliers were, in fact, a little on the flashy side, and the low-vaulted ceiling from which they hung would not, in an ideal universe, have been painted in that particular shade of deep turquoise. And even if it had been, it wouldn't have been highlighted by concealed mood lighting. This is not, however, an ideal universe, as was further evidenced by the eye-crossing patterns of the inlaid marble floor and the way in which the fronting for the 80-yard-long marble-topped bar had been made. The fronting for the 80-yard-long marble-topped bar had been made by stitching together nearly 20,000 Antarian mosaic lizard skins, despite the fact that the 20,000 lizards concerned had needed them to keep their insides in. A few smartly dressed creatures were lounging casually at the bar or relaxing in the richly coloured, body-hugging seats that were deployed here and there about the bar area. A young Vlaherg officer and his green, steaming young lady passed through the large smoked glass doors at the far end of the bar into the dazzling light of the main body of the restaurant beyond. Behind Arthur was a large, curtained bay window. He pulled aside a corner of the curtain and looked out at a bleak and drear landscape, grey, pockmarked and dismal, a landscape which, under normal circumstances, would have given Arthur the creeping horrors. These were not, however, normal circumstances, for the thing that froze his blood and made his skin try to crawl up his back and off the top of his head was the sky. The sky was... An attendant flunky politely drew the curtain back into place. All in good time, sir, he said. Seyford's eyes flashed.
Hey, hang about, you dead guys, he said. I think we're missing some ultra-important thing here, you know. Something somebody said, and we missed it.
Arthur was profoundly relieved to turn his attention from what he had just seen. He said, I said it was a sort of apres.
Yeah, and don't you wish you hadn't, said Zaphod. Ford?
I said it was odd.
Yeah, shrewd but dull. Perhaps it was...
Perhaps, interrupted the green blur, who had by this time resolved into the shape of a small, wizened, dark-suited green waiter. Perhaps you'd care to discuss the matter over drinks.
Drinks! Cried Zaphod. That was it! See what you miss if you don't stay alert!
Indeed, sir, said the waiter patiently. If the lady and gentleman would care to take drinks before dinner...
Dinner!
Zaphod exclaimed with passion. Listen, little green person, my stomach could take you home and cuddle you all night for the mere idea. And the universe, continued the waiter, determined not to be deflected on his home stretch, will explode later for your pleasure. Ford's head swiveled slowly towards him. He spoke with feeling.
Wow, he said. What sort of drinks do you serve in this place?
The waiter laughed a polite little waiter's laugh. He said, I think sir has perhaps misunderstood me.
Oh, I hope not,
breathed Ford. The waiter coughed a polite little waiter's cough. It is not unusual for our customers to be a little disoriented by the time journey, he said, so if I might suggest...
Time journey, said Zaphod. Time journey, said Ford. Time journey, said Trillian.
You mean this isn't the afterlife, said Arthur. The waiter smiled a polite little waiter's smile. He had almost exhausted his polite little waiter repertoire and would soon be slipping into his role of a rather tight-lipped and sarcastic little waiter. Afterlife, sir, he said. No, sir.
And we're not dead, said Arthur.
The waiter tightened his lips. He said. Sir is most evidently alive, otherwise I would not attempt to serve, sir. In an extraordinary gesture, which it is pointless attempting to describe, Zaphod Beeblebrox slapped both his foreheads with two of his arms and one of his thighs with the other.
Hey, guys, he said, this is crazy. We did it. We finally got to where we were going. This is Milliways.
Milliways, said Ford. Yes, sir, said the waiter, laying on the patience with a trowel. This is Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe.
End of what? Said Arthur.
The universe, repeated the waiter, very clearly and unnecessarily distinctly.
When did that end?
Said Arthur. In just a few minutes, sir, said the waiter. He took a deep breath. He didn't need to do this because his body was supplied with the peculiar assortment of gases it required for survival from a small intravenous device strapped to his leg. There are times, however, when, whatever your metabolism, you have to take a deep breath. "And now, if you would care to order your drinks at last," he said, "I will then show you to your table." Zaphod grinned two manic grins, sauntered over to the bar, and bought most of it.
Chapter 15. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It has been built on the fragmented remains of... It will be built on the fragmented... That is to say, it will have been built by this time, and indeed has been... One of the major problems encountered in time travel is not that of accidentally becoming your own father or mother. There is no problem involved in becoming your own father or mother that a broad-minded and well-adjusted family can't cope with. There is also no problem about changing the course of history. The course of history does not change because it all fits together like a jigsaw. All the important changes have happened before the things they were supposed to change, and it all sorts itself out in the end. The major problem is quite simply one of grammar. And the main work to consult in this matter is Dr. Dan Streetmenschner's Time Traveller's Handbook of 1001 Tense Formations. It will tell you, for instance, how to describe something that was about to happen to you in the past before you avoided it by time-jumping forward 2 days in order to avoid it. The event will be described differently according to whether you are talking about it from the standpoint of your own natural time, from a time in the further future, or a time in the further past, and is further complicated by the possibility of conducting conversations whilst you are actually travelling from one time to another with the intention of becoming your own mother or father. Most readers get as far as the future semi-conditionally modified sub-inverted plagal past subjunctive intentional before giving up. And in fact, in later editions of the book, all pages beyond this point have been left blank to save on printing costs. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy skips lightly over this tangle of academic abstraction, pausing only to note that the term future perfect has been abandoned since it was discovered not to be. To resume. The restaurant at the end of the universe is one of the most extraordinary ventures in the entire history of catering. It is built on the fragmented remains of an eventually ruined planet which is, or we all haven't be, enclosed in a vast time bubble and projected forward in time to the precise moment of the end of the universe. This is, many would say, impossible. In it, guests take, willen on take, their places at table and eat, willen on eat, sumptuous meals whilst watching, willing watchen, the whole of creation explode around them. This, many would say, is equally impossible. You can arrive, may an arrive and on when, for any sitting you like without prior, late for when, reservation, because you can book retrospectively, as it were, when you return to your own time. You can have on book have enter for when presooning returning when to retro home. This is, many would now insist, absolutely impossible. At the restaurant you can meet and dine with, may an meet and con with dine and on when, a fascinating cross-section of the entire population of space and time. This, it can be explained patiently, is also impossible. You can visit it as many times as you like, may an on-visit, re-on-visiting, and so on. For further tense correction, consult Dr. Streetmenschner's book. And be sure of never meeting yourself because of the embarrassment this usually causes. This, even if the rest were true, which it isn't, is patently impossible, say the doubters. All you have to do is to deposit one penny in a savings account in your own era, and when you arrive at the end of time, the operation of compound interest means that the fabulous cost of your meal has been paid for. This, many claim, is not merely impossible, but clearly insane, which is why the advertising executives of the star system of Bastablon came up with this slogan. If you've done six impossible things this morning, why not round it off with breakfast at Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe? Chapter 16. At the bar, Zaphod was rapidly becoming as tired as a newt. He
His heads knocked together and his smiles were coming out of sync. He was miserably happy. "Zaphod," said Ford, "whilst you're still capable of speech, would you care to tell me what the photon happened? Where have you been? Where have we been? Small matter, but I'd like it cleared up." Zaphod's left head sobered up, leaving his right to sink further into the obscurity of drink. "Yeah," he said, "I've been around. They want me to find the man who rules the universe, but I don't care to meet him. I believe the man can't cook." His left head watched his right head saying this and then nodded. "True," it said. "Have another drink." Ford had another pangalactic gargle blaster, the drink which has been described as the alcoholic equivalent of a mugging, expensive and bad for the head. Whatever had happened, Ford decided, he didn't really care too much. "Listen, Ford," said Zaphod, "everything's cool and fruity."
"You mean everything's under control?"
"No," said Zaphod, "I do not mean everything's under control. That would not be cool and fruity. If you want to know what happened, let's just say I had the whole situation in my pocket, okay?"
Ford shrugged. Zaphod giggled into his drink. It frothed up over the side of the glass and started to eat its way into the marble bar top. A wild-skinned sky gypsy approached them and played electric violin at them until Zaphod gave him a lot of money and he agreed to go away again. The gypsy approached Arthur and Trillian, sitting in another part of the bar.
"I don't know what this place is," said Arthur, "but I think it gives me the creeps."
"Have another drink," said Trillian. "Enjoy yourself."
"Which?" said Arthur. "The two are mutually exclusive."
"Poor Arthur, you're not really cut out for this life, are you?"
"You call this life?"
"You're beginning to sound like Marvin. Marvin is the clearest thinker I know. How do you think we make this violinist go away?"
The waiter approached. "Your table is ready," he said.
Seen from the outside, which it never is, the restaurant resembles a giant, glittering starfish beached on a forgotten rock. Each of its arms house the bars, the kitchens, the force field generators which protect the entire structure and the decayed hunk of planet on which it sits, and the time turbines which slowly rock the whole affair backwards and forwards across the crucial moment. In the centre sits the gigantic golden dome, almost a complete globe, and it was into this area that Zaphod, Ford, Arthur and Trillian now passed. At least 5 tons of glitter alone had gone into it before them and covered every available surface. The other surfaces were not available because they were already encrusted with jewels, precious seashells from Santragenus, gold leaf, mosaic tiles, lizard skins, and a million unidentifiable embellishments and decorations. Glass glittered, silver shone, gold gleamed, Arthur Dent goggled.
"Wowee," said Zaphod, "Zappo!"
"Incredible," breathed Arthur. "The people, the things."
"The things," said Ford Prefect quietly, "are also people."
"The people," resumed Arthur, "the other people." "The lights," said Trillian. "The tables," said Arthur. "The clothes," said Trillian. The waiter thought they sounded like a couple of bailiffs.
"The end of the universe is very popular," said Zaphod, threading his way unsteadily through the throng of tables, some made of marble, some of rich ultra-mahogany, some even of platinum, and at each a party of exotic creatures chatting amongst themselves and studying menus.
"People like to dress up for it," continued Zaphod. "Gives it a sense of occasion."
The tables were fanned out in a large circle around a central stage area where a small band was playing light music. At least 1,000 tables was Arthur's guess. And interspersed among them were swaying palms, hissing fountains, grotesque statuary, in short, all the paraphernalia common to all restaurants where little expense has been spared to give the impression that no expense has been spared. Arthur glanced around, half expecting to see someone making an American Express commercial. Zaphod lurched into Ford, who lurched back into Zaphod.
"Wowee," said Zaphod. "Zappo," said Ford.
"My great-granddaddy must have really screwed up the computer's works, you know," said Zaphod. "I told it to take us to the nearest place to eat, and it sends us to the end of the universe. Remind me to be nice to it one day." He paused.
Hey, everybody's here, you know. Everybody who was anybody.
Was? Said Arthur.
Well, at the end of the universe, you have to use the past tense a lot, said Zaphod, because everything's been done, you know. Hi, guys! He called out to a nearby party of giant iguana life forms. How did you do?
Is that Zaphod Beeblebrox? Asked one iguana of another iguana.
I think so, replied the second iguana.
Well, doesn't that just take that biscuit? Said the first iguana.
Funny old thing, life, said the second iguana.
It's what you make it, said the first, and they lapsed back into silence. They were waiting for the greatest show in the universe.
Hey, Zaphod, said Ford, grabbing for his arm, and on account of the third pangalactic gargle blaster missing, he pointed a swaying finger.
There's an old mate of mine, he said. Hot Black Desiato. See the man at the platinum table with the platinum suit on?
Zaphod tried to follow Ford's fingers with his eyes, but it made him feel dizzy. Finally, he saw.
Oh, yeah, he said.
Then recognition came a moment later.
Hey, he said, did that guy ever make it mega big? Wow, bigger than the biggest thing ever, other than me.
Who's he supposed to be? Asked Trillian.
Hot Black Desiato, said Zaphod in astonishment. You don't know? You never heard of Disaster Area?
No, said Trillian, who hadn't.
The biggest, said Ford, loudest, richest, suggested Zaphod. Rock band and the history of...
He searched for the word.
History itself, said Zaphod.
No, said Trillian.
Zowie, said Zaphod. Here we are at the end of the universe and you haven't even lived yet. Did you miss out?
He led her off to where the waiter had been waiting all this time at the table. Arthur followed them, feeling very lost and alone. Ford waded off through the throng to renew an old acquaintance.
Hey, Hot Black, he called out. How are you doing? Great to see you, big boy. How's the noise? You're looking great. Really, very, very fat and unwell. Amazing.
He slapped the man on the back and was mildly surprised that it seemed to elicit no response. The pangalactic gargle blaster swilling around inside him told him to plunge on regardless.
Remember the old days, he said, we used to hang out, right? The Bistro Illegal, remember? Slim's Throat Emporium, the evil drone Boozerama, great days, eh?
Hot Black Desiato offered no opinion as to whether they were great days or not. Ford was not perturbed.
And when we were hungry, you'd pose as public health inspectors, you remember that? And go around confiscating meals and drinks, right, till we got food poisoning. Oh, and then there were the long nights of talking and drinking in those smelly rooms above the Café Lou in Gretchentown, New Beetle. And you were always in the next room trying to write songs on your agitator, and we all hated them. And you said you didn't care, and we said we did because we hated them so much.
Ford's eyes were beginning to mist over.
And you said you didn't want to be a star, he continued, wallowing in nostalgia, because you despised the star system. And we said, you know, Hadra and Sully Joe and me, we said that we didn't think you had the option. And what do you do now? You buy star systems.
He turned and solicited the attention of those at nearby tables.
Here, he said, is a man who buys star systems.
Hot Black Desiato made no attempt either to confirm or deny this fact, and the attention of the temporary audience waned rapidly.
I think somebody's drunk, muttered a purple bush-like being into his wine glass.
Ford staggered slightly and sat down heavily on the chair facing Hot Black Desiato.
What's that number you do? He said,
unwisely grabbing at a bottle for support and tipping it over into a nearby glass, as it happened. Not to waste a happy accident, he drained the glass.
That really huge number, he continued. How does it go? Brum, brum, ba-da! Something. And in the stage act you do it, it ends up with a ship crashing right into the sun, and you actually do it!
Ford crashed his fist into his other hand to illustrate this feat graphically. He knocked the bottle over again.
Ship, sun, wham, bang, he cried. I mean, forget lasers and stuff. You guys are in a solar flares and real sunburn. Oh, and terrible songs.
His eyes followed the stream of liquid glugging out of the bottle on the table. Something ought to be done about it, he thought.
Hey, you want a drink, he said.
It began to sink into his squelching mind that something was missing from this reunion, and that the missing something was in some way connected with the fact that the fat man sitting opposite him in the platinum suit and the silvery trilby had not yet said, Hi, Ford, or Great to see you after all this time, or in fact, anything at all. More to the point, he'd not even moved.
Hot Black, said Ford.
A large, meaty hand landed on his shoulder from behind and pushed him aside. He slid gracelessly off his seat and peered upwards to see if he could spot the owner of this discourteous hand. The owner was not hard to spot on account of his being something of the order of 7 feet tall and not slightly built with it. In fact, he was built the way one builds leather sofas, shiny, lumpy, and with lots of solid stuffing. The suit into which the man's body had been stuffed looked as if its only purpose in life was to demonstrate how difficult it was to get this sort of body into a suit. The face had the texture of an orange and the colour of an apple, but there the resemblance to anything sweet ended.
"Kid," said a voice which emerged from the man's mouth as if it had been having a really rough time down in his chest.
Yeah,
said Ford conversationally. He staggered back to his feet again and was disappointed that the top of his head didn't come further up the man's body.
"Beat it," said the man.
"Oh, yeah?"
said Ford, wondering how wise he was being.
"And who are you?"
The man considered this for a moment. He wasn't used to being asked this sort of question. Nevertheless, after a while, he came up with an answer.
"I'm the guy who's telling you to beat it," he said, "before you get it beaten for you."
"Now listen," said Ford nervously. He wished his head would stop spinning, settle down and get to grips with the situation. "Now listen," he continued. "I am one of Hot Black's oldest friends, and..."
He glanced at Hot Black Desiato, who still hadn't moved as much as an eyelash.
"And," said Ford again, wondering what would be a good word to say after "and."
The large man came up with a whole sentence to go after "and." He said it.
"And I am Mr. Desiato's bodyguard," it went. "And I am responsible for his body, and I am not responsible for yours, so take it away before it gets damaged."
"Now wait a minute," said Ford.
"No minutes," said the bodyguard. "No waiting. Mr. Desiato speaks to no one."
"Well, perhaps you'd let him say what he thinks about the matter himself," said Ford.
"He speaks to no one," bellowed the bodyguard.
Ford glanced anxiously at Hot Black again and was forced to admit to himself that the bodyguard did seem to have facts on his side. There was still not the slightest sign of movement, let alone keen interest in Ford's welfare.
"Why," said Ford, "what's the matter with him?"
The bodyguard told him. Chapter 17. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy notes that Disaster Area, a plutonium rock band from the Gagrakaka mine zones, are generally held to be not only the loudest rock band in the galaxy, but in fact the loudest noise of any kind at all. Regular concertgoers judge that the best sound balance is usually to be heard from within large concrete bunkers some 37 miles from the stage, whilst the musicians themselves play their instruments by remote control from within a heavily insulated spaceship, which stays in orbit around the planet, or, more frequently, around a completely different planet. Their songs are, on the whole, very simple, and mostly follow the familiar theme of boy-being meets girl-being beneath a silvery moon, which then explodes for no adequately explored reason. Many worlds have now banned their act altogether, sometimes for artistic reasons, but most commonly because the band's public address system contravenes local strategic arms limitations treaties. This has not, however, stopped their earnings from pushing back the boundaries of pure hypermathematics, and their chief research accountant has recently been appointed Professor of Neo-Mathematics at the University of Maximegalon, in recognition of both his general and his special theories of disaster area tax returns, in which he proves that the whole fabric of the space-time continuum is not merely curved, it is in fact totally bent. Ford staggered back to the table where Zaphod, Arthur and Trillian were sitting waiting for the fun to begin.
"Gotta have some food," said Ford.
"Hi, Ford," said Zaphod. "You speak to the big noise boy?"
Ford waggled his head noncommittally.
"Hot Black? I sort of spoke to him, yeah."
"What did he say?"
"Well, not a lot, really. He's,
"Yeah?"
He's spending a year dead for tax reasons. I've got to sit down."
He sat down. The waiter approached. "Oh, would you like to see the menu?" he said, "or would you like to meet the dish of the day?"
"Huh?" said Ford.
"Huh?"
said Arthur.
"Huh?"
said Trillian.
"Oh, that's cool," said Zaphod. "We'll meet the meat."
In a small room in one of the arms of the restaurant complex, a tall, thin, gangling figure pulled aside a curtain.
and oblivion looked him in the face. It was not a pretty face, perhaps because oblivion had looked him in it so many times. It was too long for a start, the eyes too sunken and hooded, the cheeks too hollow. His lips were too thin and too long, and when they parted, his teeth looked too much like a recently polished bay window. The hands that held the curtain were long and thin, too. They were also cold. They lay lightly along the folds of the curtain, and gave the impression that if you didn't watch them like a hawk, they would crawl away of their own accord and do something unspeakable in a corner. He let the curtain drop, and the terrible light that played on his features went off to play somewhere more healthy. He prowled around his small chamber like a mantis contemplating an evening's praying, finally settling in a rickety chair by a trestle table, where he leafed through a few sheets of jokes. A bell rang. He pushed the thin sheaf of papers aside and stood up. His hands brushed limply over some of the 1,000,000 rainbow-coloured sequins with which his jacket was festooned, and he was gone through the door. In the restaurant, the lights dimmed. The band quickened its pace. A single spotlight stabbed down into the darkness of the stairway that led up to the centre of the stage. Up the stairs bounded a tall, brilliantly coloured figure. He burst onto the stage, tripped lightly up to the microphone, removed it from its stand with one swoop of his long, thin hand, and stood for a moment, bowing left and right to the audience, acknowledging their applause, and displaying to them his bay window. He waved to his particular friends in the audience, even though there weren't any there, and waited for the applause to die down. He held up his hand and smiled a smile that stretched not merely from ear to ear, but seemed to extend some way beyond the mere confines of his face. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," he cried. "Thank you very much. Thank you so very much." He eyed them with a twinkling eye. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "the universe as we know it has now been in existence for over 170,000,000,000,000,000,000 years and will be ending in a little over half an hour. So welcome, one and all, to Milliways, the restaurant at the end of the universe." With a gesture, he deftly conjured another round of spontaneous applause. With another gesture, he cut it. "I am your host for tonight," he said. "My name is Max Quadlepleen." Everybody knew this. His act was famous throughout the known galaxy, but he said it for the fresh applause it generated, which he acknowledged with a disclaiming smile and wave. "And I've just come straight from the very, very other end of time, where I've been hosting a show at the Big Bang Burger Bar, where I can tell you we had a very exciting evening, ladies and gentlemen, and I will be with you right through this historic occasion, the end of history itself." Another burst of applause died away quickly as the lights dimmed down further. On every table, candles ignited themselves spontaneously, eliciting a slight gasp from all the diners and wreathing them in a thousand tiny flickering lights and a million intimate shadows. A tremor of excitement thrilled through the darkened restaurant as the vast golden dome above them began very, very slowly to dim, to darken, to fade. Max's voice was hushed as he continued. "So, ladies and gentlemen," he breathed, "the candles are lit, the band plays softly, and as the force-shielded dome above us fades into transparency, revealing a dark and sullen sky hung with the ancient light of livid, swollen stars, I can see we're all in for a fabulous evening's apocalypse." Even the soft tootling of the band faded away. A stunned shock descended on all those who had not seen this sight before. A monstrous, grisly light poured in on them. A hideous light. A boiling, pestilential light. A light that would have disfigured hell. The universe was coming to an end. For a few interminable seconds, the restaurant spun silently through the raging void. Then Max spoke again. "For those of you who ever hoped to see the light at the end of the tunnel," he said, "this is it." The band struck up again. "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," cried Max. "I'll be back with you again in just a moment. And meanwhile, I'll leave you in the very capable hands of Mr. Reg Nullify and his cataclysmic combo. Big hand, ladies and gentlemen, for Reg and the boys." The baleful turmoil of the skies continued. Hesitantly, the audience began to clap. And after a moment or so, normal conversation resumed.
Max began his round of the table, swapping jokes, shouting with laughter, earning his living. A large dairy animal approached Zaphod Beeblebrox's table. A large, fat, meaty quadruped of the bovine type, with large, watery eyes, small horns, and what might almost have been an ingratiating smile on its lips. "Good evening," it lowed, and sat back heavily on its haunches. "I am the main dish of the day. May I interest you in parts of my body?" It harrumphed and gurgled a bit, wriggled its hindquarters into a more comfortable position, and gazed peacefully at them. Its gaze was met by looks of startled bewilderment from Arthur and Trillian, a resigned shrug from Fort Prefect, and naked hunger from Zaphod Beeblebrox. "Something off the shoulder, perhaps?" suggested the animal, "braised in a white wine sauce."
"Your shoulder?" said Arthur in a horrified whisper.
"But naturally my shoulder, sir," mooed the animal contentedly. "Nobody else's is mine to offer." Zaphod leapt to his feet and started prodding and feeling the animal's shoulder appreciatively.
"Or the rump is very good," murmured the animal. "I've been exercising it and eating plenty of grain, so there's a lot of good meat there."
It gave a mellow grunt, gurgled again, and started to chew the cud. It swallowed the cud again.
"Or a casserole of me, perhaps," it added.
"You mean this animal actually wants us to eat it?"
whispered Trillian to Ford.
"Me?" said Ford, with a glazed look in his eyes. "I don't mean anything."
"That's absolutely horrible," exclaimed Arthur. "That's the most revolting thing I've ever heard."
"What's the problem, Earthman?" said Zaphod, now transferring his attention to the animal's enormous rump.
"I just don't want to eat an animal that's standing there inviting me to," said Arthur. "It's heartless."
"Better than eating an animal that doesn't want to be eaten," said Zaphod.
"That's not the point," Arthur protested.
Then he thought about it for a moment.
"All right," he said, "maybe it is the point. I don't care. I'm not going to think about it now. I'll just,
The universe raged about him in its death throes.
"I think I'll just have a green salad," he muttered.
"May I urge you to consider my liver?" asked the animal. "It must be very rich and tender by now. I've been force-feeding myself for months."
"A green salad," said Arthur emphatically.
"A green salad,"
said the animal, rolling his eyes disapprovingly at Arthur.
"Are you going to tell me," said Arthur, "that I shouldn't have a green salad?"
"Well," said the animal, "I know many vegetables that are very clear on that point, which is why it was eventually decided to cut through the whole tangled problem and breed an animal that actually wanted to be eaten and was capable of saying so clearly and distinctly. And here I am."
It managed a very slight bow.
"Glass of water, please," said Arthur. "Look," said Zaphod, "we want to eat. We don't want to make a meal of the issues. Four rare steaks, please, and hurry. We haven't eaten in 576,000 million years.
The animal staggered to its feet. It gave a mellow gurgle.
"A very wise choice, sir, if I may say so. Very good," it said. "I'll just nip off and shoot myself."
He turned and gave a friendly wink to Arthur.
"Don't worry, sir," he said. "I'll be very humane."
It waddled unhurriedly off to the kitchen. A matter of minutes later, the waiter arrived with four huge steaming steaks. Zaphod and Ford wolfed straight into them without a second's hesitation. Trillian paused, then shrugged and started into hers. Arthur stared at his, feeling slightly ill.
"Hey, Earthman," said Zaphod, with a malicious grin on the face that wasn't stuffing itself. "What's eating you?"
And the band played on. All around the restaurant, people and things relaxed and chatted. The air was filled with talk of this and that, and with the mingled scents of exotic plants, extravagant foods, and insidious wines. For an infinite number of miles in every direction, the universal cataclysm was gathering to a stupefying climax. Glancing at his watch, Max returned to the stage with a flourish.
"And now, ladies and gentlemen," he beamed, "is everyone having one last wonderful time?"
"Yes,"
called out the sort of people who called out yes when comedians ask them if they're having a wonderful time. That's wonderful, enthused Max. Absolutely wonderful. And as the photon storms gather in swirling crowds around us, preparing to tear apart the last of the red-hot suns, I know you're all going to want to settle back and enjoy with me what I know we will all find an immensely exciting and terminal experience.
He paused. He caught the audience with a glittering eye. "Believe me, ladies and gentlemen," he said, "there is nothing penultimate about this one." He paused again. Tonight his timing was immaculate. Time after time he had done the show, night after night. Not that the word night had any meaning here at the extremity of time. All there was the endless repetition of the final moment, as the restaurant rocked slowly forward over the brink of time's furthest edge, and back again. This night was good, though. The audience was writhing in the palm of his sickly hand. His voice dropped. They had to strain to hear him. "This," he said, "really is the absolute end, the final chilling desolation in which the whole majestic sweep of creation becomes extinct. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the proverbial it." He dropped his voice to lower. In the stillness, a fly would not have dared clear its throat. "After this," he said, "there is nothing. Void, emptiness, oblivion, absolute nothing." His eyes glittered again, or did they twinkle? "Nothing, except, of course, for the sweet trolley and a fine selection of Aldebaran liqueurs." The band gave him a musical sting. He wished they wouldn't. He didn't need it, not an artist of his caliber. He could play the audience like his own musical instrument. They were laughing with relief. He followed on. "And for once," he cried cheerily, "you don't have to worry about having a hangover in the morning, because there won't be any more mornings." He beamed at his happy, laughing audience. He glanced up at the sky, going through the same death routine every night. But his glance was only for a fraction of a second. He trusted it to do its job, as one professional trusts another. "And now," he said, strutting about the stage, "at the risk of putting a damper on the wonderful sense of doom and futility here this evening, I would like to welcome a few parties." He pulled a card from his pocket. "Do we have," he put up a hand to hold back the cheers, "do we have a party here from the Zansel Quasia Flammarion Bridge Club from beyond the Vought Void of Kwan? Are they here?" A routine cheer came from the back, but he pretended not to hear. He peered around trying to find them. "Are they here?" he asked again, to elicit a louder cheer. He got it, as he always did. "Ah, there they are. Well, last bids, lads, and no cheating. Remember, this is a very solemn moment." He lapped up the laughter. "And do we have a party of minor deities from the halls of Asgard?" Away to his right came a rumble of thunder. Lightning arced across the stage. A small group of hairy men with helmets sat looking very pleased with themselves and raised their glasses to him. "Has-beens," he thought to himself. "Careful with that hammer, sir," he said. They did their trick with the lightning again. Max gave them a very thin-lipped smile. "And thirdly," he said, "thirdly, a party of young conservatives from Sirius B. Are they here?" A party of smartly dressed young dogs stopped throwing rolls at each other and started throwing rolls at the stage. They yapped and barked unintelligibly. "Yes," said Maxwell, "this is all your fault. You realize that?" "And finally," said Max, quietening the audience down and putting on his solemn face, "finally, I believe we have with us here tonight a party of believers, very devout believers, from the Church of the Second Coming of the Great Prophet Zarquan." There were about 20 of them, sitting right out on the edge of the floor, ascetically dressed, sipping mineral water nervously and staying apart from the festivities. They blinked resentfully as the spotlight was turned on them. "There they are," said Max, "sitting there patiently. He said he'd come again, and he's kept you waiting a long time, so let's hope he's hurrying, fellas, because he's only got 8 minutes left." The party of Zarquan's followers sat rigid, refusing to be buffeted by the waves of uncharitable laughter which swept over them. Max restrained his audience. "No, but seriously, though, folks, seriously, though, no offence meant. No, I know we shouldn't make fun of deeply held beliefs, so I think a big hand, please, for the great prophet Zarquan." The audience clapped respectfully. "Wherever he's got to!" He blew a kiss to the stony-faced party and returned to the centre of the stage.
He grabbed a tall stool and sat on it. "It's marvellous, though," he rattled on, "to see so many of you here tonight. No, isn't it, though? Yes, absolutely marvellous, because I know that so many of you come here time and time again, which I think is really wonderful, to come and watch this final end of everything and then return home to your own eras and raise families, strive for new and better societies, fight terrible wars for it. You know to be right. It really gives one hope for the future of all life kind." Except, of course, he waved at the blitzing turmoil above and around them, "that we know it hasn't got one!" Arthur turned to Ford. He hadn't quite got this place worked out in his mind. "Look, surely," he said, "if the universe is about to end, don't we go with it?" Ford gave him a three-pangalactic gargle blaster look. In other words, a rather unsteady one. "No," he said. "Look," he said, "as soon as you come into this dive, you get held in this sort of amazing force-shielded temporal warp thing, I think." "Oh," said Arthur. He turned his attention back to a bowl of soup he'd managed to get from the waiter to replace his steak. "Look," said Ford, "I'll show you." He grabbed at a napkin off the table and fumbled hopelessly with it. "Look," he said, "imagine this napkin, right, as the temporal universe, right? And the spoon as a transductional mode in the matter curve." It took him a while to say this last part, and Arthur hated to interrupt him. "That's the spoon I was eating with," he said. "Right," said Ford. "Imagine this spoon." He found a small wooden spoon on a tray of relishes. "This spoon," but found it rather tricky to pick up. "No, better still, this fork." "Hey, would you let go of my fork?" snapped Zaphod. "All right," said Ford. "All right, all right. Why don't we say that this wine glass is the temporal universe?" "What, the one you just knocked on the floor? Did I do that?" "Yes." "All right," said Ford. "Forget that. I mean, look, do you know how the universe actually began, for a kickoff?" "Probably not," said Arthur, who wished he'd never embarked on any of this. "All right," said Ford. "Imagine this. Right, you get this bath. Right, large, round bath. And it's made of ebony." "Where from?" said Arthur. "Harrods was destroyed by the Vogons." "Doesn't matter." "Well, so you keep saying. Listen." "All right. You get this bath. See? Imagine you've got this bath, and it's ebony. And it's conical." "Conical?" said Arthur. "What sort of..." "Shh," said Ford. "It's conical. So what you do is, you see, you fill it with fine white sand, right? Or sugar. Fine white sand and or sugar. Anything. Doesn't matter. Sugar's fine. And when it's full, you pull the plug out. Are you listening?" "I'm listening." "You pull the plug out, and it all just twirls away. Twirls away, you see, out of the plug hole." "I see." "You don't see. You don't see at all. I haven't got to the clever bit yet. You want to hear the clever bit? Tell me the clever bit." "I'll tell you the clever bit." Ford thought for a moment, trying to remember what the clever bit was. "The clever bit," he said, "is this. You film it happening." "Clever," agreed Arthur. "You get a movie camera and you film it happening." "Clever." "That's not the clever bit. This is the clever bit. I remember now that this is the clever bit. The clever bit is that you then thread the film and the projector backwards." "Backwards?" "Yes, threading it backwards is definitely the clever bit. So then you just sit and watch it, and everything just appears to spiral upwards out of the plug hole and fill the bath. See?" "And that's how the universe began, is it?" said Arthur. "No," said Ford, "but it's a marvellous way to relax." He reached for his wine glass. "Where's my wine glass?" he said. "It's on the floor." "Ah." Tipping back his chair to look for it, Ford collided with the small green waiter who was approaching the table, carrying a portable telephone. Ford excused himself to the waiter, explaining that it was because he was extremely drunk. The waiter said that was quite all right and that he perfectly understood. Ford thanked the waiter for his kind indulgence, attempted to tug his forelock, missed by 6 inches, and slid under the table. "Mr. Zaphod Beeblebrox?" inquired the waiter.
Yeah.
said Zaphod, glancing up from his third steak. "There is a phone call for you."
"Hey, what?"
"A phone call, sir."
"For me?"
Here? Hey, but I mean, who knows where I am?
One of his minds raced, the other dawdled lovingly over the food it was still shovelling in.
"Excuse me if I carry on, won't you?" said his eating head, and carried on. There were now so many people after him, he had lost count. He shouldn't have made such a conspicuous entrance.
Hell, why not, though, he thought. How do you know you're having fun if there's no one watching you have it?
"Maybe somebody tipped off the Galactic Police," said Trillian. "Everyone saw you come in."
"You mean they want to arrest me over the phone?" said Zayfoot. "Could be. I'm a pretty dangerous dude when I'm cornered."
"Yeah," said a voice from under the table. "You go to pieces so fast people get hit by the shrapnel."
"Hey, what is this, Judgment Day?" snapped Zayfoot. "Do we get to see that as well?" asked Arthur nervously.
"I'm in no hurry," muttered Zayfoot.
"Okay, so who's the cat on the phone?" He kicked forward. "Hey, get up there, kid," he said to him. "I may need you."
"I am not," said the waiter, personally acquainted with the metal gentleman in question, sir.
"Metal?"
"Yes, sir."
"Did you say metal?"
Yes, sir. I said that I am not personally acquainted with the metal gentleman in question.
Okay, carry on.
"But I am informed that he has been awaiting your return for a considerable number of millennia. It seems that you left here somewhat precipitately."
"Left here?" said Zayfoot. "Are you being strange? We only just arrived here."
"Indeed, sir," persisted the waiter doggedly. "But before you arrived here, sir, I understand that you left here." Zayfoot tried this in one brain and then in the other.
"You're saying," he said, "that before we arrived here, we left here?"
"This is going to be a long night," thought the waiter.
"Precisely, sir," he said. "Put your analysts on danger money, baby," advised Zayfoot.
"No, wait a minute," said Ford, emerging above table level again. "Where exactly is here?"
"But to be absolutely exact, sir, it is the Frogstar World B."